This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. A few years ago, ballroom dancing gained popularity as a favorite pastime, with competitions becoming something of a trend. We found out when we were joined by Temple University sociology professor Julia Erickson, who described the sensuality and the athleticism involved. She found ballroom dancing late in life and saw that the flirtation and socializing were good for married life. Erickson wrote about all of this in her book, Dance With Me, Ballroom Dancing and the Promise of Instant Intimacy. Let's listen. You danced as a young girl, and your parents were also ballroom dancers.
My parents were very keen ballroom dancers. They, in fact, met on a blind date ballroom dancing.
Oh, how romantic is that? But you picked it up about 10 years ago. Were you looking for the kind of intimacy that you write about?
No, I just always loved to dance. And when I met my husband, he was not a terribly good dancer, so we didn't really dance very much. And when we were about to have our 60th birthdays, and he said, well, maybe as a birthday present to one another, we could learn to do the jive. And it was just a suggestion. Mm-hmm. So as he says, he came home that night and had signed us up for dance lessons. I think I had a real desire to do it. And I think in a long relationship, you need other relationships. Right. So I like that.
So do you dance the jive with your husband?
Well, we started to learn the jive, and then we learned it. When you go, of course, they sell you more than just the jive, so right. We immediately started doing other lessons. And after about a year, my husband said, well, I'm not progressing as fast as you, so I'm going to have my own private lessons as well.
Well, do you see the world of academia as different from this world of dance?
Totally different, totally different. First of all, when you're an academic, you're not supposed to care about appearance. You're not supposed to care about clothing. You're not supposed to do your nails like I do. You're not supposed to do any of those
frivolous
things.
Isn't it?
Yes. So when you do these things, you know, it's a kind of frivolity that people have a little bit of difficulty with. And secondly, of course, being a professor is all cerebral. You know, I say to people, since I was a child, I mean, I learned to ride a bike and I learned to swim by doing rather than reading. But since I was a child, I've never done anything that by doing. And it's hard for me because mm-hmm. I'm, you know, everything I ever do, I read it first. And this is the one thing that I want to be really good at that you can't learn from reading in a book.
You have to learn
by doing. And I think that's the biggest difference between academia and dancing. But some of them have been to see me when we have student performances. Yeah. Scott always has a showcase every year where every student gets to perform. And so some of them have been to see me there. And they're very tolerant. Yeah. They're sociologists. They think it's fun.
And they're observing you in your native habitat here,
exactly.
At least on a dance floor. But what is it like for you to sort of transform yourself from this, in a sense, academic, as you describe, into this ballroom dancer? I mean, do you feel like you have two selves?
Well, I think that you asked the question before about physicality and intimacy. Mm-hmm. That's really different. I mean, university is a place where you're not supposed to touch. You're not supposed to, you know, there are so many sexual harassment laws. You're not supposed to be too affectionate. Women can get away with it more than men, but you still, you know, it's not a physical place. It's a place where you talk things out. If a student cries in your office, you hand them a tissue. And dancing
is... You don't hug them necessarily.
Dancing is a completely physical arena. You walk in. I've had experiences of going to work with new glasses and a new dress on, let's say, and nobody even noticed. And you get into the dance studio and six people comment, both men and women, in the first 3 minutes. So it's a very different world mm-hmm. like that.
But it sounded like you had to get comfortable with the closeness, the intimacy, the sensuality, the sexuality, probably.
I'm probably more comfortable than most people are, but I still had to struggle with it. I do teach sexuality, so I'm more comfortable talking about sex than most people. Philadelphia actually has a big same-sex competition, the Liberty Dance Challenge, every year. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that, so you can dance as a same-sex couple. That's the only thing that you have to be a same-sex couple. And when the men dance, particularly in Latin, they take turns taking the lead, which is quite fascinating to watch. So one man will be leading the other, and then suddenly they'll switch because they take turns to be the leader.
You have to know both parts.
Yeah exactly. So that they have to know both parts, right. And the men always dress in identical clothing, pretty much, with a little bit more razzmatazz than a Latin man would normally have. The women haven't quite figured out what to wear. So sometimes you see one woman in pants, one woman in a dress, two women in a dress, or two women in pants. So I think that
doesn't
the kind
surprise
of,
me for yes, some reason.
The difference in the way the men face it and the women face it is quite... With the women, there's always one woman who's leading and one woman who's following.
Was it hard to learn to follow?
I actually think that I'm a fairly good follower. It was what's hard is when you have a choreography, is not to anticipate the next step. So it's not that I'm trying to push Scott around. It's that I'm starting to do the next step, and he'll be saying, "Wait a minute."
Is he actually
signaled
that?
It yet? Oh yes, he tells me all the time, like, don't bring your leg forward and move until I tell you to move. Why are you turning your head? I haven't told you to turn your head.
Oh, is he bossing that way?
Oh yes.
you have to get across. You have to get across somehow.
I need to be bossed. I'm pretty assertive.
Yeah, exactly. This is all becoming clearer and clearer to me the more we go on. But one thing that you write in your book, Julia, and this is about dancing, which is the man leads, the woman follows. Mm-hmm. You teach gender studies just to connect all this at Temple University. Mm-hmm. Was that an issue for you?
Nah.
Why not?
Well,
is it dancing?
Because I think that this is playing what I'm doing here. I'm very intrigued with the idea, with trying to understand why so many professional women like myself choose to do this in their leisure. So here they are, you know, they've struggled to get equality. And then they say, oh, yeah, but in my leisure, I want to give it all up and have some guy lead me around the dance floor. I'm wearing high heels and spangles and makeup. Do I quite understand that? No, I don't.
No, but
it's very appealing.
You did this as a child. As you said, your parents met on the dance floor, and now you're back doing it again.
Yeah.
Does it satisfy the thing that you were looking for, this kind of intimacy that we've been talking about?
It's just fabulous. I love everything about it. I love the movement. I love the musicality. I love the physicality of it. I like being able to flirt and joke around with men and be safely married at the same time.
So instead of having, I mean, I don't know anything about you, but instead of having an affair, you dance with Scott?
I dance with Scott instead, yes.
You say the rumba is the sexiest of dances.
I think so.
And why so? Just from what we just heard from...
Because of the hip motion, because you're dancing and when you're swinging your hips, and there's a lot of hip action in the rumba, and you're settling your hip. And so the whole kind of way that you're moving in middle section already is, even if you're just doing it by yourself, is a very sexy kind of movement. And that you're doing it with someone else, you're looking at them, you're looking away, that there's enough time to move the steps. So it is about, you know,
seduction, isn't
it? Seduction, yeah.
And how about the audience for you when you're dancing competitively, Julie? And then we'll get to our callers. Can you sort of sense their anticipation, their interest, their curiosity, their reactions?
So one of the things that you learn to do, particularly with Latin dancing, when you get a little more comfortable, is to make eye contact with the audience, which is quite hard for you at the beginning because focusing, knowing where you're going to look, direction, is the difficult thing to learn. But once you start to do that and you can see somebody in the audience is watching you and looking at you and you've made eye contact with them, that's a very exciting experience. And you don't get that on a stage when the audience is in the dark, but when on a dance floor where the audience is sitting all around and it's lit, that I think that audience connection is a really big spur to... And professionals do that all the time. I mean, they dance around the edge of the floor if the dance is appropriate. And they're just looking at one person in the audience after the other. It's like, look at me.
And how high are your heels?
They're higher for Latin than they are for ballroom. So for Latin, they'll be 3 inches. And for ballroom, they'll be 2 or 2.5 inches.
Right.
They're not really. They're not like 7-inch heels. You couldn't dance in those.
No, I was wondering sort of how high can you go there without falling over. You can be feminine and a feminist.
Yes, and I think that you can you can have a playfulness with your feminine side. You can say, you know, well, this is just a performance. I'm putting on a show, and you can enjoy those sort of forbidden things.
And forbidden what? To wear lots of makeup, to get your hair, to wear spangles,
to be so self-absorbed. I think. It seems a little self-absorbed at times.
Well, is that a bad thing?
I don't think so. No, I mean, it is if you do it all the time.
Right.
And I think that sometimes for professional dancers, some of the dancers that I interviewed, the top professionals, it really takes over their life, and they don't really have very much else in their life except dance. But some of the ones who are really successful, it's really all they do, and they all they think about 24 hours a day. And so it's like anything else. In that way, I think it's in order to be so fantastic, you have to kind of shut the rest of the world out. But for most people, that doesn't happen.
And have you won competitions?
Well, I'm usually happy if I do reasonably well. I'm not the top dancer, but I'm sometimes frustrated with myself if I don't think I did as well as I wanted to. I've won things. I mean, I was a top silver dance student at Heritage 1 year. That's probably the best I've ever done.
You talk about age in this mm-hmm. book. I don't know exactly how old you are, but
I'm 70. I just had a 70th birthday, to which all these dancers came.
Oh.
And all the academics watched.
And this is your world, right?
Yes.
But is it, I mean, as we get older, our bodies are different. There are things we can and can't do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are things we can do.
Yes.
But do you feel limitations of a 7-year-old?
Yes, I'm not as flexible as I would be if I were mm-hmm. younger. I don't remember things. I mean, I don't have the... I find sometimes the choreographed routines don't... When I was younger, I would have just been able to have them down pat. Mm-hmm. Now I find them more difficult to learn. So that's probably more of a challenge for me. So if I don't really know my routine and I get a little tense, I can forget what the next step is.
Yeah.
I don't do that so much anymore because I've gotten more comfortable competing. But at the beginning... Any funny move on the floor by somebody else, because remember, there's lots of other couples on the floor when you're dancing, and they get in the way.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things you notice when you dance is that, when you compete, is that the women and the men look more in shape than the typical women and men. I mean, this is a more fit group of people, and I think that's probably in part resulting from dancing. So.
Well, I was wondering, this comes up in ice skating as well, figure skating, which is, some of it just seems so subjective. If you're talking about different choreographies and there's so many parts of dance that are not objectives, but it's about chemistry. And
actually, I've had judges tell me that. I've had judges tell me that, you know, I really care about musicality, and if the couple's not musical, they're just not going to do well. That's my number one thing I care about. And another judge will say, you know, if the feet aren't really good, I look at the feet first, and if the feet aren't really good, I'm not going to look at the rest of the performance. So the different judges focus on different things, and we hope it all averages out.
So do you anticipate dancing for the rest of your life?
Not to be overly dramatic. When I'm 90, he's still going to take me to a comp.
I think that might actually happen.
I do, too.
And your husband is all cool with all this stuff.
Oh, yes. He dances, too, so.
That was my 2011 conversation with Temple University Professor of Sociology and Ballroom Dancing Enthusiast Julia Erickson. She joined me to discuss her book, Dance With Me, Ballroom Dancing and the Promise of Instant Intimacy. You're listening to the dance edition of Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with renowned choreographer Bill T. Jones. Stay with us. Welcome back to the dance edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Dance choreography is as complex and theoretical as any musical or written composition, and perhaps no one illustrates this point more than Bill T. Jones. He's won multiple Tony Awards for his work, as well as a MacArthur Genius Award and a Kennedy Center Honor. He joined me to discuss his book, Storytime, The Life of an Idea, which was also a stage production. The work discussed his life in choreography, but also wrestled with the ideas behind composing a dance performance, including several insights into the work and philosophy of avant-garde composer John Cage. Let's listen. As I understand it, it wasn't until you got to college that you discovered dance. Is that right? You were, I guess, a theater major when you started out.
I guess if you want to call it that, I was lucky to be born during the Camelot. Not born, no, spiritually born. Perhaps I was born in '52, but it was the Camelot era when there was money around for these sort of social uplifting projects, and we had a drama teacher speech teacher, Miss Mary Lee Shapey, and I will always think of her as a great savior of my soul, so to speak, who said, you always want to show off. Why don't you get some skill and learn something?
This was in high school?
Oh, yeah, and in grade school even. You know, she was, and she really encouraged it. And she knew what I was going through in that German-Italian community. She asked me one day, I think we'd just seen on the evening news something that came from a church in Alabama with Martin Luther King speaking. And she said, what did you think of that? All that shouting and amen and all. And I knew it. I lived in a house with a mother who did just that. But I didn't think that white people were paying attention. But then she was paying attention. And she was actually talking to me as a young thinking person. And in a way, she was asking me, I believe she was speaking to me as a black person, which people didn't really do unless it was some way a bit patronizing. That was a great learning experience. She was my drama teacher, and she was the one during those turbulent 60s from that vantage point of a small agrarian community in upstate New York was able to keep it personal and at the same time say constantly through her actions as well as her words, there's a big world here, Bill.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Are you going to participate? Yeah. I love that about her.
Well, and how wonderful to have a teacher, especially at a young age, who sort of saw you, perhaps.
Don't we all need it?
Indeed.
We really
indeed
do.
Indeed, we do.
Yeah. Sometimes when I look at young relatives and all who have fallen back into food stamps or fallen into drug use or living in these kind of communities, what we call them ghettos, I'm thinking, hey, wait a minute. We were supposed to have escaped this now. What happened? You can either get angry, you can get depressed, you can yourself turn to drugs or excess, or you can think deeper about how progress is not in a straight line, and particularly spiritual progress.
Well, you come from such an interesting family. You were born, as you say, in 52. You were born in Florida.
I'm number 10 in a family of 12.
And number 10 in a family of 12. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as if your parents wanted to get the family out of the South.
You mean my dad wanting to be a black Yankee?
Your dad wanting to be a black Yankee. I guess you can't do that in the South, right? Or couldn't
No. My brothers and sisters, because of the migrant stream, which was good money in the 40s, if you consider 8, 9, 10 cents a 100-pound bag of potatoes, good money. But these people who were field workers thought so, and he wanted to go north where his kids could have the same advantages, as he said, the white man's kids did. It's odd whenever I speak this way, I think I'm doing, am I playing the race card? I don't know how else to talk about the experience without the specificities of it, which is one thing Storytime is able to do. The stories range from something as personal as you and I are talking about, mm-hmm. to the political, to the esoteric, to the purely gossipy art world. But that's where my head is at, and that's what's wonderful about this indeterminate process.
So do you sort of live in the world of John Cage with those more sort of abstract ideas about life and then also in the sentimental world?
Oh, I very much so. Very much so. Yes. I have, I was at Woodstock at 17. I listen sometime to music from that era. I don't listen with my companion nearby because he doesn't really like it so much. But I indulge, you know. Right. There's no harm in that. But then where does a mind get its biggest workout? You know, where does it get that kind of stretching and pulling that helps us go to another level of meaning in this life? And I do think that this life has a meaning. I don't know if it's an ultimate player, but there is something about art that helps us understand what that is.
Has that been dance then for you?
Dance has been one part of it, but I say art making is participation in the world of ideas, reading, looking at other people's work, big fan of visual arts, all of those things. Even this conversation right now, I know this is a discourse that comes with our culture and it's a privilege. But it also is, you can feel the wheels grinding as we both understand and find ways to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what art is for me. But you know what? I also love a sweaty epiphany. You know, that's why I'm a dancer who comes from an athletic tradition. Mm-hmm. My dancers move beautifully. We give full-bloodied full-bloodied, excuse me, full-bodied value.
Oh, I like full-bloodied. That's good, too.
Less blood on stage, but that happens as well. Anyways, when you come to see our shows, there's a lot of thinking up there. Mm-hmm. There's also something visceral that I hold to, and I think that has its place in the culture.
So when you were, and I keep going back to, you know, the very analog way of talking about your life, mm-hmm. but so did you discover dance? I mean, was it just taking a class and then all of a sudden you thought, this is who I am?
Well, one of my set pieces in answering that question is to say that dance found me. I was an athlete at the university. My niece, Marion Young, who is my age, she said to me one day, don't go to those track practices. Don't go to track practice. Come with me to these African dance classes. What? Just come. So my coach, nice guy, said, okay, as long as you're working on your cardiovascular, you'll be fine. Little did he know, he was giving me away. I went to that class and I opened the door and there's a kind of a sweat from a dance studio, that smell that hits you in the face. And either you run away or you think, this is for me. And there were drummers of every shade, all male, on the side, and it was hot. And there was Percival Board, this gorgeous Trinidadian man with these amazing arms. And it was a place, it was kind of a melting pot. It was the high 70s, lots of young black women wrapped in galas and with hair either like Angela Davis or Corn Road, full of pride. And, you know, we deserve to be in the front of the room because this is our culture, but we'll let you sons and daughters of Jewish lawyers and doctors, you could be in the back. And I was there to, quote, dig the scene, as we said. Oh. And before I know it, more and more time was being spent in the dance studio. I met Arnie Zane, and he said, you really want to know something about art? Let's go to Amsterdam. He took me to Europe. I saw ballet at a very high level. I began to take dance classes. And before you know it, it was clear that it was going to be in the theater, but it wouldn't necessarily be saying other people's words, not initially. That would come back to me years later. So I went off in search of a pure physical expression, which was dance.
Would you say you're self-taught? Or that you've borrowed from things that you've seen?
I've taken classes, and I've been with some pretty sophisticated thinkers, and I've so I couldn't say entirely self-taught, but no, I didn't start doing dance when I was 6 years old. I started when I was 19. Mm-hmm. But I did study Cecchetti Ballet, and I did study Humphrey Wideman. No, I didn't study the classic techniques of Horton Technique, which is Alvin Ailey. No, I did refuse to go to New York and let Mr. Ailey finish me, as people would say.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah, if you're a young black man, you know, go to New York, and that's the only place you could go. And then later came Arthur Mitchell, but there was something about my background in that German-Italian community and the allure of the counterculture that said, nobody tells you what your path should be. And I met a wonderful man, Arnie Zane, and later we met Lois Welk, who is now an important member of your community, and dance community. She was more sophisticated than I. She had graduated from a dance program, and she not only took me deeper into the classical modern world, but also pointed the way to things like contact improvisation, mm-hmm. a very democratic form developed by the great Steve Paxton using Aikido. But we were scanning constantly. Arnie was a photographer. We were in the cinema department listening to those lectures about form and time and space. So what does it mean to be self-taught? You just have to be extremely curious and hungry.
And open, it sounds like.
Yes, open. And only when you get to the middle age, you realize you thought you were totally open, but you had a lot of prejudices. Still finding that one out.
Yeah, aren't we all? And that's Bill T. Jones, our guest here. I would assume, though, and even just looking at you now, I mean, you still look like a runner or a sprinter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That also helped in terms of developing yourself as a dancer.
You know, I really don't know the answer to that. Another glib answer used to be when people would say, admiring my body, I said, 300 years of selective breeding. You know,
it's another way to think about it,
yes.
Right?
Yes, not everybody in my family has a trim stomach, though. But there was something, I do believe that dance gives back, at least the dance that I came into, which was about sweat, which was about stretching and shaping the body extreme body consciousness, which, as you know, particularly for women, can be a real problem. But it gave back. In a certain way of understanding, there are these alarm bells that go off when you haven't been moving for a while. And, you know, you do sort of are always pinching and looking at the weight. And there is an appreciation for being able to get up on your feet and move at any moment. I have a young relative who's now a former dancer, a show dancer, who is paralyzed from the waist down.
Oh, how
and
did that happen?
Health and drugs. He said to me when we were talking, one of his biggest distresses was, he said, "Uncle Bill, I always felt that I could always run away." I said, "What do you mean, physically run away or emotionally?" He said, "Well, I guess both." So there's something about a dancer. You can use your body. You can seduce. You can draw people to you. You can scram. The dance life does tend to keep you a child for a long time. It makes one very self-centered, and yet there's something so fragile, because you can be walking down the street in peak health and you go over on the side of your ankle and you're out for 5 weeks, and it seems that your life stops. But it also keeps the heart pumping, and I think that If you listen to it, you can go into your middle age and still have a pretty trim physique.
I'm interested. I understand the kind of selfishness, perhaps, even just because you have to take care of yourself.
Self-involvement.
Mm-hmm. But to feel like a child, how does dance keep someone a child?
Well, let's put it this way. Let's start with classical dance. If you think about it, a high-level ballerina probably has been, since the age of 3 or 5, going every day into a situation where people are looking at her every move and telling her what to do. And what did George Balanchine say, supposedly, to Gelsey Kirkland? "Don't think, dear. I think you do." You know, I don't know. Did he really mean that? But you didn't. In his generation, you didn't need a thinking dancer. It might have been a problem. Merce Cunningham and others changed that. But I think also there's this feeling that youth, I've got to stay young and pliable, and I've got to be able to have those qualities I had when I was 18, 19, 20. And the body changes. By the time one is in their mid-30s, it's very difficult to compete with the physical energy of a 21-year-old, particularly for men, and maybe for women as well.
You asked me during the break whether when I talk to artists, we talk about religion. I
mean, or was it a bit like talking about religion?
And I sort of hemmed and hawed and didn't exactly answer your question. I talked about the kind of deep thinking, I think, that artists engage in. They can't always talk about it, but they might experience it. But you talked about artists providing a kind of service.
Well, yes, I say that many artists, when you scratch down, they don't believe that what they do is the same thing as someone who might be a firefighter or a doctor. They believe that they're doing something that is more about philosophy. I say we're on the front line of understanding this dilemma of being a human being. And we're required to find form to do that. And ever since we understood how to make arrowheads out of stone or take burnt chalk, burnt wood, and draw on the walls, human beings have distinguished themselves as being able to do that. It's a grand tradition. I say this sounds a bit pompous. It's not a vocation. It's an avocation.
Because I keep asking you, sort of saying what you do. What are you doing? What are you doing? You're doing. You're saying, you know, I don't think about it as doing.
But you keep me honest. Because quite frankly, I've got to pay my rent as well.
Right.
I have young artists working under me who need their health insurance, who want to have children. I am just another human being that must wash my clothes as well. No. And I can be wrong. And I can be extremely arrogant. And I need to be slapped. But I love it when I get it right and people applaud and say, "Amen, brother."
So what do you look for in dancers? It looks like you look for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But is there a certain kind of dancer that you feel understands you?
Well, I would say something glib, like I'm looking for the dancer I didn't know I was looking for. There was a dancer, Arthur Avila, is one of the greatest of his generation. We came to an audition. It was so crowded. I never do this. The audition was so crowded, even before they did anything, I was walking around the room and telling people, "Please, thank you for coming. Please leave," because I knew that I wasn't going to use them. But then he stood up, a man I was not looking for, and there was something about the way in which he was doing the movement. He wasn't executing the steps the best, but the commitment And he showed me potential in the steps and in the exercises that I thought that I didn't know was there. So that dancer has got to be mesmerizing. There's a floor full of people. This dancer who is, even as I say, not necessarily the best, but I can't stop looking at him or her. You don't know until a few weeks, months, sometimes a year, if that person is right for the chemistry of the group. But there's an intuition that kicks in when you first see them attack space or make an offering of an improvisational sequence.
Do you still dance at all?
I dance when I'm very happy.
Do you?
And that's when my companion is making dinner, when I'm at a party. And I have another major solo inside of me. I hope I can find the dance. I'm sorry, I hope I can find the time to do it. And that these knees and lower back and ankles hold out.
Is that where you feel it?
Oh,
your
yes.
Years of dancing?
Right knee, because I used to be a great jumper. But unfortunately, I was always using the same leg to jump and land on. So I did some damage to it, which I never, no replacement. But I also grew impatient, and a year of physical therapy turned into about six months. I'm sorry, and I should have gone longer.
Oh.
And I have creaks and groans in places that I never had them before. But an old man dancing is a beautiful thing because he has to do much more with less.
That was my conversation with choreographer Bill T. Jones, who joined me to discuss his book Story Time, The Life of an Idea, which was also performed as a stage play. When we get back from the break, we'll continue our dance edition of Radio Times in Review when we hear from hip-hop dancer and choreographer Rennie Harris. Stay with us. Welcome back to the All Dance edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We just heard from Bill T. Jones, a choreographer who has won multiple awards, including a MacArthur Genius Award and a Kennedy Center Honor. But on the other side of the choreography coin lies hip-hop dance. It originated in the street, bringing a different flavor and requiring just as much intricacy, ability, and dedication as its more highfalutin counterpart. We learned about hip-hop dance and choreography when we were joined by Philadelphia native Rennie Harris a number of years ago. He began as a battle dancer in North Philadelphia and went on to found the hip-hop dance touring company, Rennie Harris Pure Movement. Let's take a listen.
I was looking at a video, actually, of you yesterday, mm-hmm. Talking about your work and looking at some of the choreography that you have mm-hmm. put together. And one of the things that you say to your dancers is don't count.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's mm-hmm. it's movement. And
right.
The idea that I got from you was mm-hmm. that when we're walking, we're not mm-hmm. saying 1, 2, 3, 4. We're just walking.
Right.
Is that what you're going for?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the idea of dance and what have you, I think we've been convinced, it's a Western thought, that dance is a sequence of patterns, and that in order to have this kind of numeric pattern, you have to count. You know, but truly, you know, we walk in 8 count, we talk in 8 count. Everything we do is in time. It's only when we start to think that we fall out of time. So you see that person that's out of time to music, that person's thinking about it. He's not, he or she's not just doing it, because it's in our DNA as humans to, you know, we learn through iambic pentameter. That's how we learn. So rhythm is a part of our whole deal, you know. So trying to convince people who want to become dancers to be natural, it's like trying to tell an actor, stop acting
exactly.
and just be yourself.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And so that's really, you know, what I like to, you know, especially when it comes to hip hop. we're not dancing to a 3, a 5, a 7, or a 9. It's not, you know what I mean? If you're playing classical music, you might want to listen to the composition in that way. But with hip hop, it's all 8 count, 4/4. It's all, you know, it's basic. You know what I mean? It's just about that trance. It's about putting you in that space.
Would you then have to sort of unlearn or untrain your dancers to get them to stop thinking like dancers? And
well, the interesting thing, we're at a weird crossroads when it comes to hip hop, because now hip hop is being taught in studios, and so people are trying to create this formula, and so now you have dancers who have come to studios who've been trained in the various styles of hip hop, of which, and when people train you, most of them are counting.
Right.
When we learned, we didn't count. We was like, hey, can you do that? And you're, okay, I could do it. And you would do something close to it, but you won't get it exactly. But as long as it was in time, no one really, you know, was upset about it. But now everybody's like, okay, no, arm has to be here. And it's clean, quote unquote. But to me, that's not hip hop. Hip hop is about, it's like all of us walking to the corner and, you know, you're walking in your own time. I'm walking in my own time, but we're getting there at the same time. We have our different body rhythms, you know, and that's what hip hop is about. Hip hop is about individuality, moving together, but also acknowledging, you know, your voice, how you dress, how you talk, and how you move, and your interpretation of that same movement. And so, to me, when I see the hip hop crews of today, and they're so clean with the movement, it's disappointing, because I want to see how the dancers bring to it, and that's what the difference with ballet, modern dance, it is the choreographer's vision, but with hip hop, it's the choreographer's vision, but also the dancer's contribution via their texture and how they apply their movement to the choreography.
Is there a Philly style of hip hop?
I want to say that there is a Philly style of hip hop, but I feel like that it's being slowly
disappearing,
yeah,
or because being absorbed,
yeah,
somehow.
Because of the great hip hop god, the video hip hop gods of dance, who are saying this is what it is, and so we have all these kids who are, you know, they either go to New York to learn a particular style, or go to California to learn another style, or and then they think that's what it is because it's being funneled into them via television and what have you. It is hard to hold on to a specific style regionally now, and in some places are, you know,
sure.
Well. Chicago had this footwork style, which was always there, you know, but then all of a sudden, one of the dancers got a commercial, and then everyone wanted to do footwork. And the same thing with crumping. It's, oh, that's just a new dance, you know.
So what's Philly? I mean, if
Philly, honestly, there's a, right now, I feel like we're trying to figure out what Philly's contribution is, the present contribution. Mm-hmm. But prior to the hip hop movement, so to speak, Philadelphia had its own unique street dance called GQ, and some people called it stepping, or some people called it iking. And this, you know, came from spillover from the tap. Philadelphia is a major tap town,
absolutely.
So spillover from the tap history here, also the social black clubs, and a little bit of fraternity, but it's totally different than fraternity, and. The GQ dancers would dress up in suits with hats and what have you, and they would, you know, dance these rhythms.
You did that, didn't you?
Yeah, that's what I started as a GQ dancer.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is started from, I've dated it back to interviewed a cat who he said, in 64, I saw my cousins do it. And I'm like, wow, 64, I was born in 64. So we're talking the early 60s, possibly, this GQ dance in Philadelphia. Has been a major thing for Philadelphia dancers, and it's the history of Philadelphia, like where you have go-go in D.C., you know, you have GQ in Philadelphia, and these things have been around for almost 30, 40 years, just didn't get light on them.
As you said, you did a lot of dancing as a kid, and I guess mm-hmm. just the kind of dancing that you saw on the street or you saw mm-hmm. in your neighborhood, is that?
Yeah, you know, I think in the black community, dance is just a major part of the
sure.
culture. So dance is not an extracurricular activity, you know, but rather it's part of the culture. You're mm-hmm. always going to see it. And so I think it wasn't anything.
Something unusual about
yeah,
that per se.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, I think it became unusual the day I got paid to do it. So that
and when was that?
I was about 14 years old. Yeah, and I danced with a group called the Stepmasters. The leader of that group was Frank Stewart, AKA Money from Six and Parish. And he taught me my first GQ style, which his brother taught him.
And then after that came the Scanner Boys?
The Scanner Boys, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You were part of that group as well.
Yes, ma'am. Actually, as the story goes, they came, they were younger guys who came to me because I was considered an older, old school at the time at 17. And so they came to me to ask if I was going to, you know, I guess lead or help them or what have you. And then we became, the truth of the matter is they actually took the name. The name came from the older guys than me who hung out at 19th and Jefferson, Ponce and Alfonso and all these guys over there. And we kind of took their name.
Yeah.
And we became the Scanner Boys. I mean, we were young. We were kids. They didn't care. They were, you know, just having fun. So
where are all these people today? Do you know?
You know, I haven't seen them in a while. Uh-huh. I haven't seen them in a while. Once in a while, I go through the old neighborhood of 19th and Jefferson, you know, to look at the old battlegrounds of, you know, dance.
Did it feel like a battleground?
Yeah, yeah. It's still, you know, you can still, it's still there. It's still, the energy is still there. Spirit is still there. Third and Cumberland, you know, I mean, Disco Rad, all the, you know, all the dance groups, all the DJs. I still remember. I remember, you know, every place where hip-hop went down before it was called hip-hop. Yeah.
Now, you went to Catholic school in Philadelphia.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did that, you know, and I'm always, when you talk with artists, you sort of want to know what some of the influences are and, mm-hmm. and how they got to where they're going. Mm-hmm. Is there something about going to Catholic school that led you to hip-hop in any way?
No.
Or led you away?
No, not at all.
was it sort of a totally separate life in a way?
Well, no, I mean, I didn't think of it other than it was school, right. And we had to dress up, you know what I mean? And there was some rules, and then I went to Jesu Elementary School on 18th and Thompson, and, you know, we had the luxury of having one classroom, you know, so that was kind of cool. I think I would have got lost in the kind of bigger system. Mm-hmm. And I met a guy by the name of Lewis Bailey, but his middle name was Johnny Bailey. And he turned out to be the youngest son of Bill Bailey.
Oh.
So it's the first time I actually saw the backslide, you know, because he was like a little kid and he was tapping and then doing this kind of backslide, what people call the moonwalk. But
sure.
It's really.
And people, people can see that when you
see
that.
Yeah, but yeah, so it. So at some way, there was some connectors for dance there, and you know, and I think I came into my own and at Jesu as a dancer too as well.
Was that a rough neighborhood where you grew up in North Philly?
Yes.
I mean, was dance a way of protecting yourself or a place where
I was in my own little bubble.
Were you?
You know, I think a lot of us, you know, sometimes, you know, it's almost like you escape into this whole other world. Like
it's all around you, but you're not.
You know, it doesn't exist. You know, you see the violence, you see so-and-so. It only comes, it becomes real when it comes at you. And it's like, well, why are you dancing? Or why, you know, or your gender or your manhood, so to speak, is challenged because you're still dancing and you're 15 years old. Like, that's for kids, you know. You know, that's old. Why are you doing that? Right. You know, that kind of thing. Get a job.
What did you say? I mean, what was the answer to that?
I didn't know what I just looked at him like, I'm crazy. I didn't know what to say. Like, yeah. Well, you know, I just never turned me on to hang out, to do anything other than that. I played sports, football, basketball, that kind of thing. And I danced. I skateboarded for, like, years, you know. So I was just into stuff, you know what I mean? So I was so busy being into those type of things, I didn't have time to, like, hang out with the serious cats, you know what I mean? Which was cool. And I think, and also, too, once they realized the best part about that, and I'm sure a lot of dancers from the neighborhoods can sign on this, is that the quote-unquote, so-called gangsters or hustlers in the neighborhood at some point begin to protect you because they know that you're not in that space. They know that you're not. That's not your thing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and they'll tell you, go, you know, you need to leave this party right now, or you need to, you know, don't mess with him because he's blah, blah. And so at one point, we really started to have that kind of protection from each part of the city. So people didn't know where we were from, the Scanner Boys. Originally, we started in North Philly, but because we had members from each part of the city, we would walk from West Philly to North Philly and North Philly to South Philly, and we would go to these DJ battles and also these dance battles. So people just automatically thought that because we were there, we were part of, you know, from that part of the city, you know. So we can, you know, today I had a guy say, hey, aren't you Randy from the Scanner Boys? I'm like, oh, yeah. You know,
oh, really?
Like, yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah. The people remember the Scanner Boys. Scanner Boys were major in this city, you know.
I read somewhere, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that for a time you considered the priesthood?
Yes. Yeah, so when I went to Roman Catholic from
high school.
For high school. And I started to study religion. You know, so I was like religion 1, 2, and 3, and I was, you know, okay, you know, I was thinking about, hey, I'm gonna be a priest, and I went to Divine Word Seminary in Bordentown. I think it's Bordentown,
really?
New Jersey. Yeah.
Wow.
And I go on the weekends. They had these programs. You go on the weekends and you could study and you know, just kind of figure out if this is your calling kind of thing. And I did that for about a year. Like during the winter, we'd go on the weekends. And then in the summer, there was like a 2-week thing, that, you know, intensive that you would go. And I think, you know, after a while, you know, I had got a girlfriend and that went to pot right there, you know, so.
It's hard to be celibate, right? So if you got
like,
a girlfriend.
I was like, oh, I don't think, you know, so that changed that. But I feel like, you know, what I do now is still part of, you know, sort of a priesthood in a way.
Well, I was wondering about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I still love religion. I mean, I read everything that has to do with religion, whom, you know, Christianity, the Zen, you know.
So in a certain way, part of you pursuing at least thinking about the priesthood, and the other part of you dancing, doing hip hop?
Yeah, but I always felt like, you know, dance was a worship. Dance has always been a worship, you know, and that's why we've always done it, to celebrate, you know, the spirit within us. Like, how many times have we gone to, like, for the so-called people who don't dance professionally, how many times have we gone to a party or to a club and danced to, like, 6 in the morning without no drug or no drink, but we're not professional, but we're able to do this, you know, because we're taken over by spirit, to me, and that's, the Holy Ghost comes in, and I feel like it's the only time that one of the times that we feel good and that we're communing with God is when we dance. Because I don't know anyone who's ever ever danced free of their mind, just danced and not felt good. And so I always felt like this was the connection. Right. And so through dance, I felt, you know, I was able to still worship and talk about my story, which would eventually, you know, help others. And the interesting thing was that I didn't come to this realization until I was like 33, you know. So
a journey.
Yeah, journey.
You had a piece. I haven't seen it. I have to say it's an autobiographical solo. Prince Scarecrow's Road to the Emerald City, in which you dance.
Yes,
you dance solo. And I ran across a review of it. The writer Sarah Kaufman says, and this is about you, Harris's sheer presence and the piercing emotional impact of his moves, that made his story so rich, immediate, and raw. Harris shows us that hip hop dance is more than background of a music video, more than a commercial spectacle. Hip-hop digs deep, and what it brings up in him feels like nothing less than the unprocessed truth. That's a pretty powerful description of, and she loved the piece, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things in the very beginning when I started performing in theater was that, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, that makes me feel uncomfortable, you know, what you're talking about or whatever it was. And I was like, oh, okay, thanks. You know, I thought
that
it was cool.
That was the idea.
That was, I mean, not intentionally to make anyone feel uncomfortable, but I felt like, well, first of all, I couldn't do anything but tell the truth, you know what I mean, about, I'm not going to, like, color-code it or trying to make it easy for people in that way, because I never thought of it that way, because hip-hop was just do it, and it's there in your face, that kind of thing. So why not the theater is, you know, is there and is right in your face, too, you know? But I think as I start to figure out what I was doing and how it was affecting people, and I start to think, yeah, that's right, you should be uncomfortable. Mm. This is not about me performing. You know, I used to say to my dancers, you know, my monkey dancing days are over. I'm not performing on stage and doing flips for people and all that kind of thing. If I'm going to do it this time, I'm going to do it where it's going to affect some. I'm going to do what I want to do, and I want it to affect other people in a way that makes them think. So if they're thinking about it, if they're thinking about it, whether good or bad, that's a good plus for me.
And that was my conversation with hip-hop dancer and choreographer Rennie Harris. He joined me to discuss his life in Philadelphia and the founding of his company, Rennie Harris Pure Movement. And that wraps up the all-dance edition of Radio Times in Review. Thanks for joining us. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.